Welcome to the Do Your Good podcast series. In this podcast series, you'll hear from me, Sybil, and other experts in the field to help you make your money matter and make a huge difference in the world. I come to you with over two decades of experience as a person who's helped donors give away over $45 million in donations, both large and small. This podcast series is meant to give you the tools you need to be effective in the world and fund nonprofits and issues that you care about with meaning and purpose, and to make a true, deep difference in the world. Hello, everybody. So if you're an avid listener of my podcasts, and if you've looked at my trainings on my website at doyourgood.com, you'll see that I divide donors up into three types. And I challenge you all to think about what type of donor you are. There's a sustainer donor, a campaigner donor, and a launcher donor. And they're very different types of donors. If you're a sustainer donor, it means you like to give general support grants to the nonprofits you care about. You'll do a lot of research about those nonprofits. But once you've done the research, you give them the money and you let them decide how they want to spend it. If you're a campaigner kind of donor, you're very, very worried about changing a societal norm that you see needs fixing. Like you're really worried about climate change and you think that we really need to make a difference there, or human trafficking or houselessness, you name the issue. That's the thing that inspires you. If you want to change a societal norm around a very important issue, it means you're a campaigner donor, and that means that you often want to give more project-type grants with tangible outcomes and shorter timeframes and turnarounds, and you're more interested in changing that societal norm and making a difference that way than you are necessarily in any one nonprofit. If you're a launcher donor, you're similar to a campaigner in that you want to change a societal norm, but you tend to really like to fill a gap. You don't want to go along with the flow. You want to make sure that you're seeing something. There's a big societal norm that needs to change. It's not good anymore. And there's something that no nonprofit is addressing yet that you feel really needs to happen in order to make that difference, make the difference, really shift that societal norm. And a lot of times you'll come in and you'll give seed funding to catalyze a bunch of nonprofits into filling that gap and making that difference. If you want to know more about the three different types of donors that I see, please check out my website because I have a special lesson just about that where you can think about the three different types, think about what kind of donor you are. The reason I'm bringing it up now is a lot of times if you're a sustainer donor, the conversations that I have with folks like John Esterly, I just did the rerun of my interview with him last week, or with Rachel Humphrey from the Justice Funders Group. If you are a sustainer donor, the kind of strategies that Rachel and John and others focus on are really conducive to a sustainer donor approach, where you're giving general support grants, you're supporting the organizations on the ground, you're making it as easy as possible for them to ask for funds to do the work they're doing on the ground. However, if you're a campaigner or launcher donor, you are somebody who wants to change a societal norm. And a lot of times that means you're giving project grants with tangible benchmarks and timelines because you're very focused on making a difference in a particular issue area. So you might also give general support grants, but if you're a campaigner or launcher donor, there's definitely some project work in there. I wanted to offer you my interview with Michael Mantell because he founded an organization called Resources Legacy Fund. And I wanted you to learn about organizations like this. These are organizations that are expert grant makers. They also have experts on staff who know how to move the needle on changing a societal norm. Resources Legacy Fund works on natural resources issues. There's other similar types of organizations that work on other areas as well. And I just wanted to be sure that you knew that even if you are a campaigner or launcher donor, there's organizations and institutions out there that are working hard to help streamline the grant-making process so that you can make a big difference in the world. Michael, I am so happy you're here today. You are one of my mentors. I have so much appreciation for everything you've done. specifically to help donors give money effectively in any number of really important campaigns, both in California, across the country, and around the world. And you're the founder of Resources Legacy Fund. And so I'm just really happy to have you on this podcast so that we can talk about how you created it, what you thought about in terms of where you wanted to focus. And then, you know, now you're also transitioning out of, well, not completely out, but your role is changing at RLF. And I know a lot of donors are always interested in how people do that well, especially when you're a founder and a leader. Before we get into all of your wonderful tips for my audience about how they can give money away effectively, can you talk to me a little bit about your personal journey and what led you to start Resources Legacy Fund?
Sure, Sybil. And it's a privilege to be with you on this and to have been able to work with you over this past more than a decade on so many important efforts. You know, I should start at the beginning. I was an undergrad at Berkeley and decided then at a tumultuous time in this country with Vietnam and civil rights and so forth to date myself. It's even a more tumultuous time, unfortunately, right now, but that I really wanted to devote myself to the environment. And I thought the best way to do that was to become a lawyer because I didn't have a strong aptitude. I mean, I really enjoy science, but I knew that I wasn't going to become an expert in science. So I went to law school, as you know, at Lewis and Clark, where you went, law school in Portland, and which had a great environmental law curriculum at the time, still does. And Oregon was really at the forefront at that time in the country in terms of states moving on the environment. And I was able, post-law school, to work for a local government and then work for a big international nonprofit, World Wildlife Fund. And then was lured back to California, where I'm from, to become Undersecretary for Natural Resources for the state of California, and had a wonderful time, just an incredible amount of learning, working in state government on a host of issues involving natural resources. And then was asked actually by the Dave and Lucille Packard Foundation if I'd be interested in helping them develop some new programs. And the experiences I had in government, but also at World Wildlife Fund, showed me, first of all, the value of government when it can do things right, but also how nonprofits can motivate and philanthropy can motivate and prod government and partner with government to help government go further than it ever could go. And so the opportunity with the Packard Foundation was really compelling to me. And as a result of designing some new programs with them, we decided with their encouragement to create, after looking at a lot of different ways of operationalizing this, including becoming staff of the foundation, including joining an existing NGO, and including creating a new entity, decided to create a new entity, which became Resources Legacy Fund, to be nimble, to be creative, to be entrepreneurial, but also to be well managed and well thought of by philanthropies as a place that could help move the needle, but in ways also that could work collaboratively with a bunch of philanthropies who are interested in a common agenda. So we launched the World Resources Legacy Fund, or RLF, in 2000. And it's just been a wonderful journey of, and I do think having that government experience is incredibly helpful in terms of really getting, just establishing a really broad network, but really understanding how government works and what it needs from the outside to make it live up to its potential. And so a lot of our work over the years has been both formally partnering with governments, in some cases through MOUs and more collaborative efforts, but also prodding government at the right time in the right ways to push it to go further than it might. So it's this combination of having RLF be able to play what I would call the inside game, working collaboratively with government, but also play the outside game in pushing government, and then also having flexibility to run statewide ballot measure campaigns and to be involved in federal legislative efforts too, to drive federal action as well.
So there's so much to unpack there, Michael. Thank you for talking about your story. And I had forgotten you went to Lewis and Clark Law School, my alma mater too. So that's wonderful.
And now for an ad, but don't go away because there's lots more to talk about.
Hello, everyone. I want to let you know that I am putting forward a pretty exciting new podcast season, which is going to focus on the journey I took with one of my clients to think through effective funding strategies to reduce firearm-related suicide in rural and remote communities, specifically looking at Oregon as an example.
So tune in to my podcast series September 30th through October 21st. Every Monday, I'll have a new special episode specifically discussing this issue. Thanks a lot. Michael, there's so much in RLF that I think a donor can learn from in terms of how you structured it. First, the story about how you formed it while in conversation with the Packard Foundation to think about how can you create essentially a pooled fund of with a bunch of different foundations, pooling funds to create a separate institution like RLF to really move the needle on issues. So essentially, it was a bunch of foundations that are interested in campaigns or changing the norm and to really move the needle on an issue or issues on environment. So you were able to pool funds to form that. And then you're also talking about lobbying and ballot measures. So the way you structured allowed you to not only do tax deductible kind of work, public education work, but you also had separate institutions that were connected but separate for legal purposes to be able to do some of the lobbying and the other work, which is, I think, super cool. And like when I was a consultant, I still am a consultant for RLF. You know, I have played all those different roles for you too. I was a lobbyist. I was also working on the C3 side. So you have all that flexibility there. Can you talk a little bit more first about why you identified this need to not just work at Packard, but to pool funds to be able to really push campaigns that won? And talk to me a little bit about some of those campaigns that won and like why this was a success.
Sure. Well, initially, I give a lot of credit to the Packard Foundation, you know, not only for taking a risk on me, but wanting to be creative and entrepreneurial in this new venture. Part of their central thinking was if they helped create and incubate a new entity, it would make it easier and they would do what they could to lure other philanthropies to join in with them on common efforts. And at that time, this, we're talking about the late 1990s, early 2000s, there was a lot of talk about philanthropic collaboration on the environment, but there really wasn't much action. It was more talk than action. I think that's changed for the good in a lot of cases. It still needs to go further. But and within a year of starting off, Packard with me helped get the Moore and Hewlett Foundations and the Goldman Foundation involved in an effort to restore and protect San Francisco Bay, which was really in danger of being overtaken by Phil. We actually, working with Senator Feinstein and the state government of California at the time, the foundations put up $35 million collectively to help the state and the feds acquire 16,000 acres of wetlands from Cargill to be restored in a scientific way. And the government's put up over $150 million. For that effort. And that's continued on to this day. And in fact, just stay on that for a minute, we successfully pulled together a campaign in 2016, a political campaign in the nine counties that surround San Francisco Bay. The first time ever that the same measure appeared on all ballots of the nine counties to create a parcel tax that we won by over 73% of the vote collectively, to create a $500 million regional funding source for Bay restoration. So that foundation investment over time of $38 million has now helped bring about $1 billion in public funding for Bay stewardship and restoration. And to go deeper on this, what Packard did was they really wanted, that's why we ended up creating a whole new entity, because they wanted the flexibility to do lobbying, to use C3 dollars appropriately, not that they could give, but others could give, unrestricted for lobbying purposes, that is influencing government and trying to press government to spend more money. But then also we created ultimately a C4 mechanism, the Fund for a Better Future, that allowed us to do political ballot measure campaigns and to lobby Congress directly and state legislature directors on policy matters. There's a little known exception to the IRS rule that allows foundations to lobby or have its agents a lobby on appropriation matters, where if a foundation is thinking of putting money into a project or has put money into a project and it wants public money. And this creative mechanism that we created with Packard allowed us to do that with being able to attract other unrestricted money into it. So, I mean, there's a lot more, as you said, to unpack here. But I think it is incumbent upon donors who actually want to move the needle to get creative, to get entrepreneurial, and to find the right people to work with that have the flexibility to, again, in total compliance with the law, to move money in a variety of different ways to accomplish their desired outcomes.
Well, and I love that story, Michael. And I know RLF has many, many stories like that, where you have success in really working nimbly and pooling money to be able to move the needle on key issues. I will also ask you about your experiences from any kind of failures or learnings that you have. I'm going to definitely bring that out. But before we go there, you touched on something really important. And that is that it sounds like you have, in the organization that you helped found, many staff who are experts in the field that you're working in, that whatever the donors care about. So they're pooling money, but you're also providing expertise. Can we talk a little bit more about that too?
Absolutely. So, and this has been sometimes hard with some donors to articulate well, and I'll take the blame for that. But there are times when we are both a grant seeker and a grant maker. And there are times when we actually work with donors to figure out exactly what it is they want to do and then move the money. There are times when we work with donors who have a general idea of what we want to do, and we develop it further with them and then go in, help implement it. And so it just depends on the particular needs and interests of the donor. But as a result of the position we occupied early on and as we evolved, we have brought together a really unique group of staff who have expertise in lots of different fields, in land and climate, oceans, freshwater, particularly, but who also have campaign experience, who also have had government experience in some cases, who are also just generalists and who are with no egos, just really interested in accomplishing things. So it's not about credit to us. In fact, we spent a lot of time. We thought we were more effective if we were behind the scenes. And so we worked hard to not be out publicly and give more attention to the issues and to the groups that we were working directly with, and let them get the credit, let them get the visibility and help increase their capacity. And I think it's helped us achieve more than we might have otherwise. It's a really wonderful group of dedicated professionals and staff who care about having donors get as far as they possibly can and achieving great wins without any real recognition or visibility.
Yeah, I love that. And that is a really important point, that you are a grant maker. And that's really, you know, the instigation, the start of the organization was because of foundations thinking about how to do something creatively. And you also are seeking grants. So you're in this nice intermediary position, and you have experts in your organization that can help with the wins.
And now for an ad, but don't go away because there's lots more to talk about. Hello, everyone. I'm so glad that you're enjoying my podcast. In my podcast, I hope to talk to you, the wonderful donors and philanthropists that I work with, to help you think through the most effective way to make your money matter. I also, in my podcast series and through all my trainings, want to help and support the nonprofits that are out there trying to raise money and hone their pitch. Because I'm somebody that works with donors, I get pitched all the time by amazing nonprofit leaders, so I know what it takes to raise money effectively. Please check out everything I have to offer at www.doyourgood.com. I have a whole host of course materials and lessons, videos, downloadable documents, a blog that I keep updated. All of it is 100% free for you to see and review and learn from. Please check it out. Again, www.doyourgood.com. Thanks a lot.
Talk to me a little bit about when things didn't go so well and what your learnings were from that, because I feel like we can learn just as much from that as we can from all your wonderful successes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, so we ended up running or being intimately involved in statewide ballot measures in California between 2000 and 2020, so 20 years, where the state and regional areas that we were involved in, voters approved over $34 billion of bonds for natural resources, for land, for climate resilience, for oceans, and for fresh water. Some of those are local park measures. Some of those are broader statewide measures. We also did campaigns on policy issues, including one that was trying to upend California's climate change law that we successfully defeated. The one campaign that I particularly and our team was directly involved in that we lost, the only one that we lost during that time, was a measure in 2010, which was a very down year economically, to create a vehicle registration fee that would help fund California state parks. And it was a bad year to be on the ballot, and it was not as well run a campaign as we would have liked. And we lost, and we got concerned about the polling firm we were using. We were concerned about the information we were getting about the viability of this campaign. And so we, as you said, we try to learn from these experiences. It was a time when California State Parks, which is a remarkable state park system, was in severe decline. So we really re-examined how we did campaigns, who were the consultants we used, how to more professionalize them. But then in 2012, California had a very bad budget year, and there were massive cuts proposed for state parks. It became a scandal. It was disclosed that state parks had over $50 million that they had been hiding from the legislature and even from the California Department of Finance. So there was a whole implosion of state parks. This is one of these stories of, you know, turning lemons into lemonade. With the defeat of the ballot measure and thinking, wow, how are we going to pull state parks back together? And then this major disaster at state parks, we turned to philanthropy, to major foundations, and to the state, and said, let's develop a partnership between us and philanthropy and the state to redo California state parks. And we came with this idea of creating a commission, the Parks Forward Commission, of august people and staffed it to work collaboratively with the state to figure out how to turn state parks around. And that commission issued its recommendations and how to build more confidence in state parks that it could manage well and manage money well. And that commission issued its report in 2015. A number of the measures that were recommended have been implemented. And in 2018, the legislature had enough confidence in state parks to put a measure on the California ballot, a $4.1 billion measure, a lot of the money going to state parks and to underserved communities in California. My colleague chaired the campaign. We raised money for the campaign, and we got over 60% of the vote for a whole new tranche of money for state parks and a newly created state parks department. So there have been failures, yes, but you know, I don't consider them a failure totally if you learn from them and apply the lessons you've learned to keep moving forward. And so I think that's a good example where we didn't succeed at first, but we figured out what we had done wrong and redid it and moved forward. And now with the surpluses in California's funding and all this new federal money, the state parks has billions of dollars now coming into it. And I'll just say, because of that experience in California, I was contacted through a mutual colleague by the governor then of Montana, Steve Bullock, who was having trouble with his state parks. We created a similar kind of commission in Montana that did great work. And Governor Bullock at the time said to me, his biggest long-term agenda was creating a new funding source for state parks. Subsequently, we were able to team up with proponents for legalized marijuana in Montana, and we got 50% of the money from a new tax for legalizing marijuana to go for parks and outdoor recreation. And in 2020, when the whole state went very conservative for all its candidates and other issues, we got 55% of the vote for that measure. And now state parks is well funded in Montana.
I love those stories. And I'm just thinking a lot about an experience I had in a trustee meeting quite a few years ago. And I was in this meeting, and one of the trustees said to me while I was talking about a campaign that they were funding, they said, "Well, Sybil, I don't understand. Doesn't this stuff just happen? Wait a minute. Why? What? This is," it was really eye-opening. I mean, they were in a good place. They were sort of like, I thought things just happened. It was such an open, honest comment. And what you just described explains how things don't just happen. And as a donor, you can be really strategic and work with people like you, Michael, and your team at RLF or other organizations like this to really help move the needle on something. So I'm so happy you're here getting interviewed today, because you're just offering us all such great words of wisdom. I'd love
to. Let me just say, Sybil,
Go, Michael.
Just on that, I do think that we all have this tendency when things work well, it's like, of course they work well because it's the right thing to do. And until you dig deeper, you don't understand all the ins and outs and the frustrations and the challenges and the setbacks that you get, how you work hard with so many different interests to surmount those obstacles to ultimately win. Anything worthwhile doing is not easy. And it takes a team and funders who are really dedicated and willing to take risks and willing to stay in it for the long term. But it doesn't happen automatically. None of this happens automatically.
Right, exactly. So Michael, another thing that I've observed is that, you know, you founded this organization and you're not going to say this, but I noticed that you're very beloved in the organization. Like you've created a really good, healthy group of people that are working well on so many issues. And now you've decided to transition out of running the organization. You've decided that, you know, very recently, and there's a new person at the helm. I do talk a lot with donors about how do they support and think about significant changes in leadership. Also, nonprofits struggle with this too. When there's an executive director who's super charismatic and everyone trusts them, as they're transitioning out, how do you do it well? And so I'd love you to talk to me a little bit about what went through your thought process when you decided you wanted to transition and change your role at RLF. And, you know, when you decided the time was right and how you think things are going now in this transition, because it's pretty new.
Sure. So we got funded to do a strategic plan in 2016, hired an outside consultant and worked closely with our board and a lot of partners that we have to figure out where we were and where we needed to go. And that plan was a 5-year plan through 2021. And we raised some money to help implement that plan because I didn't want it to be just another plan that sat on the shelf. I actually took it seriously. And I had a great board, it is still a great board that is just diverse, really broad experiences across a lot of different sectors, but also took their fiduciary responsibilities very seriously, which I valued and I sought. And they were not a rubber stamp board. I was never looking for that. And we set benchmarks, we had implementation plans, and I held myself and the team accountable every year in terms of the board reviewing of where we were and where we needed to be. And it started to occur to me around 2019 or so that I need to start planning for my future, but also for the organization's future. When we first created it with the Packard Foundation, we thought that it would only need, we were never interested in creating an organization that would exist in perpetuity. We only wanted a viable organization as long as it was value added and played a unique role. And it seemed as we finished the strategic plan effort that actually there was a role for RLF to continue for at least 10 to 20 more years, that this intersection between government and philanthropy was really important. And RLF served a really valuable purpose in that. So as part of that, I consciously tried to, as part of the plan effort, delegate authority to have a much more decentralized structure. So I wasn't the hub. It was, as one person characterized it, moving from a hub organization where everything came through me to a networked organization where people had much more autonomy and authority, obviously in a coordinated fashion, and developed leadership teams and an executive management team and provided access to coaching to various people so they could continue to grow in their professional attributes and skills. I never wanted to be one of those CEO founders who stayed too long. We've all run into that. We've all seen how that plays out. I wanted to leave when the organizations were robust and had a future. And when I felt I still was respected and still had things to offer. And these are very dynamic times. Things are changing rapidly. I just came to the conclusion prior to COVID that I would shoot for exiting in 2022. That, or maybe even 2021, no one anticipated COVID and what implications it would have. And that I would hire an executive coach to help me, who has a lot of experience and I could work well with to help me navigate this. I informed my board, but it was all very kept quiet and worked hard to build a really solid structure for the time that I would leave. And also I just felt with all the new, you know, dynamics and appropriate focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion, which was a centerpiece of our efforts and has been for a long time, that fresh new leadership would be really valuable at this time in the organization's evolution. So I spent the better part of 2 years nurturing that with the board, with staff. I didn't let any of the staff know until 2021 that I decided to leave at the end of 2021 or early 2022. And then we had a very thoughtful process of moving things further down the organization. The board created a search committee. They hired a search firm, did a national search, and picked a really, really outstanding individual in my successor, Arvi Garbo, who took the helm in early January of this year and has kept me on as a senior advisor to help during this transition and to work on a couple of projects that are near and dear to my heart where I feel like I can add value.
That's great. What are those projects, Michael? What's still near and dear to your heart?
Well, they all are, but one was...
Yeah, I knew that was a trick question once I asked you.
One is an effort we launched with the Pew Foundation on Indigenous-led conservation in Canada. And then Pew asked us to work with them on developing more of a focus on Indigenous-led conservation globally, which is really important in terms of advancing 21st century conservation. And it actually has great applicability in the United States as well with tribes and Native Americans. And we hosted a project on the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition on that national monument. We worked a lot with tribes throughout the West. And it's something that I feel really important and really, it's called for a lot of creativity, a lot of new thinking. And so it has motivated me and I'm staying with it. Another one, it has to do with the commitment in California, but in some other states, but also by the Biden administration and globally on 30% conservation of land and coastal resources by the year 2030. It's something that is really important for climate resilience and for climate mitigation, and something really important for tribal engagement, for equitable access, and for the future of biodiversity. So we hosted a project called the Campaign for Nature, which has built support among 80 countries that have committed now to 30 by 30 with the Global Convention on Biodiversity coming up to be looked at for renewal in Montreal next month. And then in California, we were able to get Governor Newsom to commit to 30 by 30 and developed a partnership with the state to implement that. And it's well on its way. And then also working closely with a lot of partners at the federal level in terms of the federal administration. So there's a lot of other things that I care deeply about, but the 30 by 30 effort and how to further Indigenous-led conservation are two of the ones that I've stayed the closest to since I left the helm.
That's great. And you also in your volunteer time are on boards of various nonprofits as well, right? So you're staying very actively engaged, Michael.
Yeah, I'm chairing the Wilderness Society Governing Council, which I care a lot about and which is quite involved, obviously, in 30 by 30 and in equitable access and Native American-led conservation. And then I've also had the privilege of serving on the Monterey Bay Aquarium Board for several years, and we'll continue that, given what an incredible institution it is, not only for educational purposes, but also for policy, striving for policy wins. And they were a leader in a recent battle, California, but also nationally and globally. But the win was in California on new standards for plastic, greatly reducing plastics in the our environment.
Thanks for all that. And thanks for all you do, Michael. Anyone who's listening to this, the information about Resource Legacy Fund, and the other organizations you mentioned will be in the show notes too. So if folks are listening and they're like, oh, what Michael has to say, I want to keep looking into this, you can. Just check out the show notes. Michael, thanks again for your time. Do you have anything you want to add before we go so that, you know, my listeners can really think even more about all the good things you said? Any take homes you want to be sure we don't forget?
Well, Sybil, thanks for this opportunity and thanks for all you do. I just, to the donors who are listening, your work is so important. It's so great what you're doing. It's always a privilege to be able to work with people like you. I just encourage you to be as creative, to think as big as you possibly can, and to work with the right people who care deeply about making things happen, but have this, not only are great visionaries, but also know how to make things happen. As one of my favorite quotes is one by Nelson Mandela, obviously used in a much bigger context, but it's something to the effect of vision without action is merely daydreaming. Action without vision is not getting you very far. It's vision and action together that can change the world. So I just encourage you to keep that in mind.
That's so great, Michael. And just thanks again for being my mentor all these years, and best of luck to you in your next stage.
Thanks, Sybil. Take care.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I enjoyed making it for you. So if you want to find out more about what I have to offer, please check out www.doyourgood.com and learn more ways to make your money matter. Until next time, do your good and be well.